The Politburo chief raised his glass. I drink to successful and cordial negotiations. Rutledge smiled and hoisted his glass as well. As do I, sir. The cameras got it. The news media people were circulating around, too. The cameramen were doing mainly what they called locator shots, like any amateur would do with his less expensive minicam. They showed the room at an artificial distance, so that the viewers could see the colors, with a few close-ups of the furniture on which no one was supposed to sit, with somewhat closer shots of the major participants drinking their drinks and looking pleasant to one another. This was called B-roll, intended to show viewers what it was like to be at a large, formal, and not overly pleasant cocktail party. The real news coverage for the event would be by people like Barry Wise and the other talking heads, who would tell the viewer what the visuals could not. Then the coverage would shift back to CNN's Washington studio, down the hill from Union Station, where other talking heads would discuss what had been leaked or not leaked to them, then discuss what they, in their personal sagacious wisdom, thought the proper course for the United States of America ought to be. President Ryan would see all this over breakfast, as he read the papers and the government-produced early bird clipping service. Over breakfast, Jack Ryan would make his own terse comments to be noted by his wife, who might discuss it over lunch with her colleagues at Johns Hopkins, who might discuss it with their spouses, from whom it would go no farther. In this way, the president's thoughts often remained a mystery. The party broke up at the predetermined hour, and the Americans headed back to the embassy in their official cars. "So, what can you tell us off the record?" Barry asked Rutledge, in the sanctity of the stretch Lincoln's back seat. "Not much, really," the Assistant Secretary of State for Policy replied. "We'll listen to what they have to say, and they'll listen to what we have to say, and it'll go from there."
"They want MFN. Will they get it?"
"That's not for me to decide, Barry, and you know that." Rutledge was too tired and jet-lagged for intelligent conversation at the moment. He didn't trust himself to speak under these circumstances, and figured Wise knew that. The reporter was leaning on him for just that reason.
"So, what are you going to talk about?"
"Obviously, we'd like the Chinese to open their markets more, and also to take a closer look at some issues we have, like patent and copyright violations that American business has complained about."
"The Dell computer issue?"
Rutledge nodded.
"Yes, that's one."
Then he yawned. "Excuse me, the long flight. You know how it is."
"I was on the same airplane," Barry Wise pointed out.
"Well, maybe you're just better at this than I am," Rutledge offered. "Can we postpone this discussion a day or so?"
"If you say so," the CNN reporter agreed.
He didn't much like this preppy asshole, but he was a source of information, and Wise was in the information business. The ride was a brief one, in any case. The official delegation hopped out at the embassy, and the embassy cars took the newsies back to their hotels. The embassy had sleeping accommodations for the entire official party, mainly to ensure that anything they said wouldn't be recorded by the MSS bugs in every hotel room in the city. This was not to say that the accommodations were palatial, though Rutledge had a comfortable room. Here protocol failed Mark Gant, but he did have a comfortable single bed in his small private room and a shared bathroom with a shower. He opted instead for a hot bath and one of the sleeping pills the physician who accompanied the official party had issued him. It was supposed to give him a solid 8 hours or so, which would just about synchronize him with local time by the morning. There would then be a big working breakfast, much like the astronauts got before a shuttle launch, and as much of an American tradition as the Stars and Stripes over Fort McHenry. Nomori caught the arrival of the trade delegation on Chinese TV, which he watched mainly to hone his language skills. These were improving, though the tonal nature of Mandarin drove him slightly nuts. He'd once thought Japanese was hard,
but it was a walk in the park compared to Goryeo. He looked at the faces, wondering who they were. The Chinese narrator helped, stumbling badly over Rutledge, however. Well, Americans murdered Chinese names, too, except for simple ones like Ming and Wang. And listening to an American businessman try to make himself understood to a local was enough to make Nomura gag. The commentator went on to talk about the Chinese position on the trade talks, how America owed the PRC all manner of concessions. After all, was not China generous in allowing Americans to spend their worthless dollars for the valuable products of the People's Republic? In this, China sounded a lot like Japan had once done. But the new Japanese government had opened up their markets. While there was still a trade deficit in Japan's favor, fair competition on the playing field had muted American criticism, though Japanese cars were still less welcome in America than they had been. But that would pass, Nomura was sure. If America had a weakness, it was in forgiving and forgetting too rapidly. In this he greatly admired the Jews. They still hadn't forgotten Germany and Hitler. As well they shouldn't, he thought. His last thought before retiring was to wonder how the new software was working on Chai's computer, and if Ming had actually installed it or not. Then he decided to check. Rising from bed, he switched his laptop on and... Yes, Chai's system lacked Ming's transcription software, but it was transmitting what it had. Okay, fine. They had linguists at Langley to fiddle with that. He didn't have the desire to do so, and just uploaded it and headed back to bed. Damn, Mary Pat observed. Nearly all of it was unreadable, but this was a second Zorga source. That was evident from the pathway it had taken through the net. She wondered if Nomura was showing off, or had somehow managed to get in the pants of a second high-ranking Chinese government secretary. It wouldn't exactly be a first for a field officer to have that active a sex life, but it wasn't all that common either. She printed it up, saved it to disk, and called for a linguist to come up and translate. Then she downloaded Songbird's current take. It was becoming as regular as the Washington Post, and a lot more interesting. She settled back in her chair and started reading the translation of Ming's latest notes from Minister Feng Gan. He'd be talking about the trade negotiations, she hoped. Then, to see that, sure enough, he was. This would be important, the DDO thought. She'd soon be surprised to find out how wrong that impression was. Chapter 23 Down to Business. Bacon and eggs, toast and hash brown potatoes, plus some Colombian bean coffee. Gant was Jewish, but not observant, and he loved his bacon. Everyone was up and looking pretty good, he thought. The government issued black capsule, they all called it that, evidently some sort of tradition that he didn't know about, had worked for all of them. And the cookie pushers were all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Most of the talk, he noted, was about the NBA. The Lakers were looking tough again. Rutledge, Gant saw, was at the head of the table chatting amiably with Ambassador Hitch, who seemed a solid citizen. Then a more ruffled employee of the embassy came in with a manila folder whose borders were lined with striped red and white tape. This he handed to Ambassador Hitch, who opened it at once. Gant realized at once that it was classified material. There wasn't much of that to be seen at Treasury, but there was some, and he'd been screened for a top-secret special access clearance as part of his employment on Secretary Winston's personal staff. So there was intel coming in from Washington for the negotiations. Exactly what it was about he couldn't see, and didn't know if he would see it. He wondered if he could flex his institutional muscles on this one, but Rutledge would be the one who decided if he got to see it or not, and he didn't want to give the State Department puke the excuse to show who was the he-bull in this herd. Patience was a virtue he'd long had, and this was just one more chance to exercise it. He returned to his breakfast, then decided to stand and get more off the buffet. Lunch in Beijing probably wouldn't be very appealing, even at their foreign ministry building, where they would feel constrained to show off their most exotic national dishes. And fried panda penis with candied bamboo roots wasn't exactly to his taste. At least the tea they served was acceptable, but even at its best, tea wasn't coffee.
Mark? Rutledge looked up from his seat and waved the treasury guy over.
Gant walked over with his refilled plate of eggs and bacon.
Yeah, Cliff?
Ambassador Hitch made room for Gant to sit down, and a steward arrived with fresh silverware. The government could make one comfortable when it wanted. He asked the guy for more hash browns and toast. Fresh coffee arrived seemingly of its own volition.
Mark, this just came in from Washington. This is code word material.
Yeah, I know. I can't even see it now, and I am not allowed to have any memory of it. So, can I see it now?
Rutledge nodded and slipped the papers across.
What do you make of these foreign exchange figures?
Gant took a bite of bacon and stopped chewing almost at once.
Damn, they're that low? What have they been pissing their money away on?
What does this mean?
Cliff, once upon a time Dr. Samuel Johnson put it this way. Whatever you have, spend less. Well, the Chinese didn't listen to that advice.
Gant flipped the pages.
It doesn't say what they've been spending it on.
Mainly military stuff, so I am told, Ambassador Hitch replied.
Or things that can be applied to military applications, especially electronics. Both finished goods and the machinery with which to make electronic stuff. I gather it's expensive to invest in such things.
It can be, Gant agreed.
He turned the pages back to start from the beginning. He saw it was transmitted with the tap dance encryption system. That made it hot. Tap dance was only used for the most sensitive material because of some technical inconveniences in its use. So this was some really hot intelligence, telescope thought.
Then he saw why.
Somebody must have bugged the offices of some very senior Chinese officials to get this stuff.
Jesus.
What does this mean, Mark?
It means they've been spending money faster than it's coming in, and investing it in non-commercial areas for the most part.
Hell, it means they're acting like some of the idiots we have in our government. They think money is just something that appears when you snap your fingers, and then you can spend it as fast as you want and just snap your fingers to get some more. These people don't live in the real world, Cliff. They have no idea how and why the money appears.
He paused. He'd gone too far.
A Wall Street person would understand his language, but this Rutledge guy probably didn't.
Let me rephrase. They know that the money comes from their trade imbalance with the United States, and it appears that they believe the imbalance to be a natural phenomenon, something they can essentially dictate because of who they are. They think the rest of the world owes it to them. In other words, if they believe that, negotiating with them is going to be hard.
Why? Rutledge asked.
Ambassador Hitch, he saw, was already nodding. He must have understood these Chinese barbarians better.
People who think this way do not understand that negotiations mean give and take. Whoever's talking here thinks that he just gets whatever the hell he wants because everybody owes it to him. It's like what Hitler must have thought at Munich. I want, you give, and then I am happy. We're not going to cave for these bastards, are we?
Those are not my instructions, Rutledge replied.
Well, guess what? Those are the instructions your Chinese counterpart has. Moreover, their economic position is evidently a lot more precarious than what we've been given to expect.
Tell CIA they need better people in their financial intelligence department, Gant observed.
Then Hitch shifted his glance across the table to the guy who must have run the local CIA office.
Do they appreciate how serious their position is? Rutledge asked.
Yes and no. Yes, they know they need the hard currency to do the business they want to do. No, they think they can continue this way indefinitely. that an imbalance is natural in their case because...
Because why?
Because they think they're the fucking master race? Gant asked. Again it was Ambassador Hitch who nodded.
It's called the Middle Kingdom Complex.
Yes, Mr. Gant, they really do think of themselves in those terms, and they expect people to come to them and give. Not for themselves to go to other people as supplicants.
Someday that will be their downfall. There's an institutional, maybe a racial arrogance here that's hard to describe and harder to quantify. Then Hitch looked over to Rutledge. Cliff, you're going to have an interesting day. Gant realized at once that this was not a blessing for the Assistant Secretary of State for Policy.
They should be eating breakfast right about now, Secretary Adler said over his Hennessy in the East Room. The reception had gone well. Actually, Jack and Kathy Ryan found these things about as boring as reruns of Gilligan's Island. But they were as much a part of the presidency as the State of the Union speech. At least the dinner had been good. One thing you could depend on at the White House was the quality of the food. But the people had been Washington people. Even that, Ryan did not appreciate, had been greatly improved from previous years. Once Congress had largely been populated with people whose life's ambition was public service, a phrase whose noble intent had been usurped by those who viewed $130,000 per year as a princely salary. It was far less than a college dropout could earn doing software for a computer game company, and a hell of a lot less than one could make working on Wall Street, and whose real ambition was to apply their will to the laws of their nation. Many of them now, mainly because of speeches the president had made all over the country, were people who actually had served the public by doing useful work, until, fed up with the machinations of government, they had decided to take a few years off to repair the train wreck Washington had become, before escaping back to the real world of productive work. The First Lady had spent much of the evening talking with the junior senator from Indiana, who in real life was a pediatric surgeon of good reputation, and whose current efforts were centered on straightening out government health care programs before they killed too many of the citizens they supposedly wanted to assist. His greatest task was to persuade the media that a physician might know as much about making sick people well as Washington lobbyists did, something he'd been bending surgeons' ear about most of the night.
That stuff we got from Mary Pat ought to help Rutledge. I'm glad that Gant guy is there to translate it for him. Cliff is going to have a lively day while we sleep off the food and the booze, Jack.
Is he good enough for the job?
I know he was tight with Ed Keelty. That does not speak well for the guy's character.
Cliff's a fine technician, Adler said, after another sip of brandy. And he has clear instructions to carry out, and some awfully good intelligence to help him along. This is like the stuff Jonathan Yardley gave our guys during the Washington Naval Treaty negotiations. We're not exactly reading their cards, but we are seeing how they think, and that's damn near as good. So yes, I think he's good enough for this job, or I wouldn't have sent him out.
How's the ambassador we have there? POTUS asked.
Carl Hitch? Super guy. Career pro, Jack, ready to retire soon. But he's like a good cabinet maker. Maybe he can't design the house for you, but the kitchen will be just fine when he's done. And you know I'll settle for that in a diplomat. Besides, designing the house is your job, Mr. President.
Yeah. Ryan observed.
He waved to an usher, who brought over some ice water. He pushed the booze enough for one night, and Kathy was starting to razz him about it again.
Damn, being married to a doctor, Jack thought.
Yeah, Scott, but who the hell do I go to for advice when I don't know what the hell I'm doing?
Well, I don't know, Eagle replied.
Maybe some humor, he thought. Try doing a seance and call up Tom Jefferson and George Washington. He turned with a chuckle and finished his Hennessy.
Jack, just take it easy on yourself and do the fucking job. You're doing just fine, trust me.
I hate this job, Swordsman observed with a friendly smile at his Secretary of State.
I know. That's probably why you're doing it pretty well.
God protect us all from somebody who wants to hold high public office. Hell, look at me. Think I ever wanted to be sextate? It was a lot more fun to eat lunch in the cafeteria with my pals and bitch about the dumb son of a bitch who was. But now, shit, they're down there saying that about me. That ain't fair, Jack. I'm a working guy.
Tell me about it.
Well, look at it this way. When you do your memoirs, you'll get a great advance from your publisher.
The Accidental President? Adler speculated for the title.
Scott, you get funny when you're drunk. I'll settle for working on my golf game.
Who spoke the magic word? Vice President Jackson asked as he joined the conversation.
This guy whips my ass so bad out there, Ryan complained to Secretary Adler, that sometimes I wish I had a sword to fall on.
What's your handicap now?
Not playing much, Jack. It slipped to 6, maybe 7.
He's going to turn pro. Senior tour, Jack advised.
Anyway, Jack, this is my father. His plane was late and he missed the receiving line, Robbie explained.
Reverend Jackson, we finally meet.
Jack took the hand of the elderly black minister. For the inauguration, he'd been in the hospital with kidney stones, which probably had been even less fun than the inauguration.
Robbie's told me a lot of good things about you.
Your son is a fighter pilot, sir, and they exaggerate a lot.
The minister had a good laugh at that.
Oh, that I know, Mr. President, that I know.
How was the food? Ryan asked. Hosea Jackson was a man on the far side of 70, short like his son, and rotund with increasing years, but he was a man possessed of the immense dignity that somehow attached to black men of the cloth.
Much too rich for an old man, Mr. President, but I ate it anyway.
Don't worry, Jack. Pap doesn't drink, Tomcat advised.
On the lapel of his tuxedo jacket was a miniature of his Navy wings of gold. Robbie would never stop being a fighter pilot.
And you shouldn't either, boy. That Navy taught you lots of bad habits, like bragging on yourself too much.
Jack had to jump to his friend's defense.
Sir, a fighter pilot who doesn't brag isn't allowed to fly. And besides, Dizzy Dean said it best. If you can do it, it isn't bragging. Robbie can do it.
Or so he claims. They started talking over in Beijing yet? Robbie asked, checking his watch.
Another half hour or so, Adler replied. It's going to be interesting, he added, referring to the Zorga material.
I believe it, Vice President Jackson agreed, catching the message.
You know, it's hard to love those people.
Robbie, you are not allowed to say such things, his father retorted. I have a friend in Beijing.
Oh?
His son didn't know about that. The answer came rather as a papal pronouncement.
Yes, Reverend Yu Fa An, a fine Baptist preacher, educated at Oral Roberts University. My friend Jerry Patterson went to school with him.
Tough place to be a priest. Or minister, I guess, Ryan observed.
It was as though Jack had turned the key in the minister's dignity switch.
Mr. President, I envy him. To preach the gospel of the Lord anywhere is a privilege, but to preach it in the land of the heathen is a rare blessing.
Coffee? A passing usher asked. Hosea took a cup and added cream and sugar.
This is fine, he observed at once. One of the fringe bennies here, Pap, Jackson told his dad with considerable affection.
This is even better than Navy coffee. Well, we have Navy stewards serving it.
Jamaica Blue Mountain costs like $40 a pound, he explained.
Jesus, Robbie, don't say that too loud. The media hasn't figured that one out yet, POTUS warned.
Besides, I asked. We get it wholesale, $32 a pound if you buy it by the barrel.
Gee, that's a real bargain,
the VP agreed with a chuckle. With the welcoming ceremony done, the plenary session began without much in the way of fanfare. Assistant Secretary Rutledge took his seat, greeted the Chinese diplomats across the table, and began. His statement started off with the usual pleasantries that were about as predictable as the lead credits for a feature film.
The United States,
he went on, getting to the meat of the issue, has concerns about several disturbing aspects of our mutual trading relationship. The first is the seeming inability of the People's Republic to abide by previous agreements to recognize international treaties and conventions on trademarks, copyrights, and patents. All of these items have been discussed and negotiated at length in previous meetings like this one, and we had thought that the areas of disagreement were successfully resolved. Unfortunately, this seems not to be the case. He went on to cite several specific items, which he described as being illustrative, but in no way a comprehensive listing of his areas of concern. Similarly, Rutledge continued, commitments to open the Chinese market to American goods have not been honored. This has resulted in an imbalance in the mercantile exchange which ill serves our overall relationship. The current imbalance is approaching $70 billion, and that is something the United States of America is not prepared to accept. To summarize the People's Republic's commitment to honor international treaty obligations and private agreements with the United States has not been carried out. It is a fact of American law that our country has the right to adopt the trade practices of other nations in its own law. This is the well-known Trade Reform Act, enacted by the American government several years ago. It is my unpleasant obligation, therefore, to inform the government of the People's Republic that America will enforce this law with respect to trade with the People's Republic forthwith, unless these previously agreed-upon commitments are met immediately, Rutledge concluded. Immediately is a word not often used in international discourse. That concludes my opening statement. For his part, Mark Gant halfway wondered if the other side might leap across the polished oak table with swords and daggers at the end of Rutledge's opening speech. The gauntlet had been cast down in forceful terms not calculated to make the Chinese happy. But the diplomat handling the other side of the table—it was Foreign Minister Shen Tang—reacted no more than he might on getting the check in a restaurant and finding that he'd been overcharged about $5 worth. Not even a look up. Instead, the Chinese minister continued to look down at his own notes, before finally lifting his eyes as he felt the end of Rutledge's opening imminent, with no more feeling or emotion than that of a man in an art gallery looking over some painting or other that his wife wanted him to purchase to cover a crack in the dining-room wall. "Secretary Rutledge, thank you for your statement," he began in his turn. "The People's Republic, first of all, welcomes you to our country, and wishes to state, for the record, its desire for a continued friendly relationship with America and the American people. We cannot, however, reconcile America's stated desire for friendly relations with our action to recognize the breakaway province on the island of Taiwan as the independent nation it is not. Such action was calculated to inflame our relationship, to fan the flames instead of helping to extinguish them. The people of our country will not accept this unconscionable interference with Chinese internal affairs, and—" The diplomat looked up in surprise to see Rutledge's hand raised in interruption. He was sufficiently shocked by this early breach of protocol that he actually stopped talking. "Minister," Rutledge intoned, "the purpose of this meeting is to discuss trade. The issue of America's diplomatic recognition of the Republic of China is one best left to another venue. The American delegation has no desire to detour into that area today." Which was diplo-speak for, "Take that issue and shove it." "Mr. Rutledge, you cannot dictate to the People's Republic what our concerns and issues are," Minister Shen observed, in a voice as even as one discussing the price of lettuce in the street market. The rules of a meeting like this were simple. The first side to show anger lost. "Do go on, then, if you must," Rutledge responded tiredly. "You're wasting my time, but I get paid whether I work or not," his demeanor proclaimed. Gant saw that the dynamic for the opening was that both countries had their agendas, and each was trying to ignore that of the other in order to take control of the session. This was so unlike a proper business meeting as to be unrecognizable as a form of verbal intercourse. And in terms of other intercourse, it was like two naked people in bed, purportedly for the purpose of sex, starting off their foreplay by fighting over the TV remote. Gant had seen all manner of negotiations before, or so he thought. This was something entirely new and, to him, utterly bizarre. "The renegade bandits on Taiwan are part of China in their history and heritage, and the People's Republic cannot ignore this deliberate insult to our nationhood by the Ryan regime." Minister Shen, "The government of the United States of America has a long history of supporting democratically elected governments throughout the world. That has been part of our nation's ethos for over 200 years. I would remind the People's Republic that the United States of America has the longest-lived government in the world. We have lived under our constitutional form of government for well over 200 years. That is a small number in terms of Chinese history, but I would remind you further that when America elected her first president and first Congress, China was ruled by a hereditary monarch. The government of your country has changed many times since then, but the government of the United States of America has not. Thus it is well within our power, both as an independent nation under recognized international law, and also as a moral right as a long-lived and therefore legitimate form of government, both to act as we choose and to foster governments like our own. The government of the Republic of China is democratically elected, and therefore it commands the respect of similarly chosen governments of the people like our own. In any case, Minister, the purpose of this meeting is to discuss trade. Shall we do that? Or shall we fritter away our time discussing irrelevancies?" Nothing could be more relevant to this discussion than the fundamental lack of respect shown by your government, by the Ryan regime, shall I say, for the government of our country. The Taiwan issue is one of fundamental importance to... He droned on for another 4 minutes. Minister Shen, "The United States of America is not a regime of any sort. It is an independent nation with a freely elected government chosen by its people. That experiment in government which we undertook when your country was ruled by the Manchu dynasty is one which you might consider imitating at some future date, for the benefit of your own people. Now, shall we return to the issue at hand, or do you wish to continue wasting your own time and mine by discussing a topic for which I have neither instructions nor much in the way of interest?"
"We will not be brushed aside so cavalierly as that," Shen responded, earning Rutledge's brief and irrelevant respect for his unexpected command of the English language. The American chief diplomat settled back in his chair and looked politely across the table, while he thought over his wife's plans for redecorating the kitchen of their Georgetown townhouse. Was green and blue the right color scheme? He preferred earth tones, but he was far more likely to win this argument in Beijing than that one in Georgetown. A lifetime spent in diplomacy didn't enable him to win arguments with Mrs. Rutledge over items like decorating. So it went for the first 90 minutes, when there came time for the first break. Tea and finger food was served, and people wandered out the French doors. A strange place to find those, Gant thought, into the garden. It was Gant's first adventure in diplomacy, and he was about to learn how these things really worked. People paired off, American and Chinese. You could tell who was who from a distance. Every single one of the Chinese smoked, a vice shared by only two of the American delegation, both of whom looked grateful for the chance to enjoy their habit indoors in this country. They might be trade Nazis, the Treasury Department official reflected, but they weren't health Nazis.
"What do you think?" a voice asked. Gant turned to see the same little guy who'd bugged him at the reception. His name was Shui Ma, Gant remembered, all of 5 foot nothing, with poker player's eyes and some acting ability. Smarter than he appeared to be, the American reminded himself. So how was he supposed to handle this? When in doubt, Gant decided, fall back on the truth.
It's my first time observing diplomatic negotiations.
It's intensely boring, Gant replied, sipping his dreadful coffee.
Well, this is normal, Shui answered.
Really? It's not that way in business. How do you get anything done?
Every endeavor has its process, the Chinese man told him.
I suppose. Can you tell me something? Telescope asked.
I can try.
What's the big deal about Taiwan?
What was the big deal when your civil war began? Shui replied, with a clever question of his own.
Well, okay, but after 50 years, why not call it even and start over?
We do not think in such short terms, Shui answered with a superior smile.
Okay, but in America we call that living in the past.
Take that, you little chink.
They are our countrymen,
Shui persisted.
But they have chosen not to be. If you want them back, then make it advantageous for them. You know, by achieving the same prosperity here that they've achieved there.
You backward commie.
If one of your children ran away from home, would you not work for his return?
Probably, but I would entice him, not threaten him, especially if I didn't have the ability to threaten him effectively.
And your military is for shit, too.
So the briefings had told them before flying over.
But when others encourage our child to abscond and defy their father, are we not to object?
Look, pal, Gant responded, not quite showing the inward heat he felt, or so he thought. If you want to do business, then do business. If you want to chat, we can chat. But my time is valuable, and so is the time of our country, and we can save the chat for another time.
And then Gant realized that no, he wasn't a diplomat, and this was not a game he could play and win.
As you see, I am not gifted at this sort of exchange. We have people who are, but I am not one of them. I am the kind of American who does real work and earns real money. If you enjoy this game, that's fine, but it's not my game. Patience is a good thing, I suppose, but not when it impedes the objective, and I think your minister is missing something.
What is that, Mr. Gant?
It is we who will have what we wish to have out of these meetings, Gant told the little Chinese man, and realized instantly that he'd stuck his own foot into his mouth about to the knee. He finished his coffee and excused himself, then headed unnecessarily for the bathroom, where he washed his hands before heading back outside. He found Rutledge standing alone examining some spring flowers.
Cliff, I think I fucked something up, Gant confessed quietly.
What's that? The assistant secretary asked, then listened to the confession.
Don't sweat it. You didn't tell them anything I haven't already told them. You just don't understand the language.
But they'll think we're impatient, and that makes us vulnerable, doesn't it?
Not with me doing the talking inside, Rutledge answered, with a gentle smile. Here I am Jimmy Connors at the U.S. Open, Mark. This is what I do.
The other side thinks so, too.
True, but we have the advantage. They need us more than we need them.
I thought you didn't like taking this sort of line with people, Gant observed, puzzled by Rutledge's attitude.
I don't have to like it. I just have to do it. And winning is always fun.
He didn't add that he'd never met Minister Shen before and therefore had no personal baggage to trip over, as often happened with diplomats who had been known to put personal friendship before the interest of their countries. They usually justified it by telling themselves that the bastard would owe them one next time, which would serve their country's interest. Diplomacy had always been a personal business, a fact often lost on observers, who thought of these verbose technicians as robots. Gant found all of this puzzling, but he would play along with Rutledge because he had to, and because the guy at least acted as though he knew what the hell he was doing, whether he did or not. Gant wondered how he'd be able to tell. Then it was time to go back indoors. The ashtrays had been cleaned and the water bottles replenished by the domestic help, who were probably all politically reliable functionaries of one sort or another, or more likely professional intelligence officers,
who were here because their government took no chances with anything, or at least tried not to. It was, in fact, a waste of trained personnel, but communists had never been overly concerned with utilizing manpower in an efficient way. Minister Shen lit a smoke and motioned for Rutledge to lead off. For his part, the American remembered that Bismarck had counseled the use of a cigar in negotiations, because some found the thick tobacco smoke irritating, and that gave the smoker the advantage. Minister, the trade policies of the People's Republic are set in place by a small number of people, and those policies are set in place for political reasons. We in America understand that. What you fail to understand is that ours truly is a government of the people, and our people demand that we address the trade imbalance. The People's Republic's inability to open markets to American goods costs the jobs of American citizens. Now, in our country, it is the business of the government to serve the people, not to rule them. And for that reason, we must address the trade imbalance in an effective way. I fully agree that it is the business of government to serve the interests of the people. And for that reason, we must consider also the agony that the Taiwan issue imposes on the citizens of my country. Those who should be our countrymen have been separated from us, and the United States has assisted in the estrangement of our kinsmen. The remarkable thing, Rutledge thought, was that this droning old fart hadn't died from smoking those damn things. They looked and smelled like the lucky strikes his grandfather had died of at age 80. It had not been a death to please a physician, however. Grandpa Owens had been driving his great-grandson to South Station in Boston, when, lighting one, he dropped it into his lap and, in retrieving it, strayed onto the wrong side of the road. Grandpa hadn't believed in seat belts either. The bastard actually chain-smoked, lighting a new one with the butt of the previous one, like Bogey in a 30s movie. Well, maybe it was a way for the Chinese to pursue their population control policy, but in rather an ugly way. Mr. Foreign Minister, Rutledge started off, when it was next his turn, the government of the Republic of China is one elected in free and fair elections by the people who live in that country. In America's eyes, that makes the government of the Republic of China legitimate. He didn't say that the government of the People's Republic was therefore illegitimate, but the thought hung in the room like a dark cloud. And that makes the government in question worthy of international recognition, as you may have noticed has been the case in the last year. It is the policy of our government to recognize such governments. We will not change policies based upon firm principles to suit the wishes of other countries which do not share those principles. We can talk until you run out of cigarettes, but my government's position in this case is set in stone. So you can recognize this fact and allow the meeting to move on to productive areas, or you can beat this dead horse until nothing is left of it. The choice is yours, of course, but is it not better to be productive than not? America cannot dictate to the People's Republic that which concerns us. You claim to have your principles, and surely we have our own, and one of ours is the importance of our country's territorial integrity. For Mark Gant, the hard part was keeping an impassive face. He had to pretend that all this made sense and was important, when he'd much prefer to set up his computer to review stock prices, or, for that matter, read a paperback book under the rim of the table. But he couldn't do that. He had to pretend that this was all interesting, which, if successfully done, could get him nominated for the next Academy Award ceremonies for Best Actor in a Supporting Role, for keeping awake during the most boring contest since the Iowa Grass Growing Championships, the winner is